tutti, welcome to Engines of Creation podcast. I'm your host, Christian Mastrodonato. In this podcast, I bring together my knowledge in complex systems with my experience in leading technology innovation and new product development to explore how successful products, organizations, and ideas emerge. I'm so happy to come back with a great new conversation. In this episode, we are going to meet Bruce Sinclair, a seasoned expert in digital transformation, who will unveil a wealth of knowledge and practical wisdom in navigating the complexities of modern business. With a background in IoT and private equity investments, Bruce brings a unique perspective to the discussion, emphasizing the pivotal role of business imagination in driving successful digital transformations. As the founder of several startups and writer of two books, IoT Inc. and Digital Operating Partner, Bruce has a wealth of experience guiding organizations through the intricacies of adopting emerging technologies, aligning diverse perspectives and unlocking value in the digital landscape. The interview begins with Bruce emphasizing the crucial role of business imagination in driving successful digital transformation. He stressed the need to understand the business value before delving into technology solutions. According to Bruce, technology should be viewed as an enabler to achieve business objectives. He discussed the challenges of gaining consensus within large organizations, highlighting the importance of aligning their diverse perspectives towards a common goal. Bruce also pointed out how private equity firms, due to their focus on results, can act as effective catalysts for change. The conversation then shifts towards the digital realm, with a focus on AI, data science, and analytics, all applied to IoT mainly. Bruce emphasizes the importance of collecting and transforming data to create value. He introduces the concept of digital twin, explaining how it serves as a virtual representation of physical objects or systems. Digital twins contribute to understanding and optimizing value creation by providing insights into various aspects of a system. Bruce elaborated on building simulation models, utility models, usability models, and monetization models. All these models help in creating an effective digital representation of a system, enabling better decision-making. The discussion extended the challenges of implementing live digital twins and closing the loop for automated decision-making, predicting a future where augmentation of human capabilities would be more prevalent than full replacement. The conversation also touches upon the alignment between technology and regulations. Bruce emphasizes the need for regulation to catch up with rapidly evolving technologies to foster innovation. He notes that regulations can sometimes lag behind technological advancements, potentially stifling innovation. The interview concludes with highlighting the importance of imagination, stating that leaders with imagination can see beyond the presented challenges and envision innovative solutions. Throughout the interview, Bruce Sinclair provides valuable insights into the intricacies of digital transformation. His emphasis on imagination, understanding business value, and leveraging technology as enablers reflected a holistic approach to successful leadership in the face of complexity. I can't wait to start this conversation. So, let's go. Thanks a lot, Bruce, for being here. Really happy that you accepted to join Engines of Creation and to have a chat today. I'm sure the listeners are going to love this conversation. So I think, as usual, at least for me, the first question is always asking the guest to introduce himself. And so it would be great if you can tell us a bit more about you.
Okay, sure. And thank you for having me on the show, Chris. My name is Bruce Sinclair. I am the managing partner of Digital Operating Partners. Just to give a quick kind of overview, I started out as a mathematician. I was a professional programmer. I got into marketing on the product side, on the brand side. And then I was the CEO of a number of technology companies, hardware, software, and AI, actually, which is interesting, many, many years ago. And then after that, I wanted a lifestyle change. And so I went into consulting, first with my first company, IoT Inc. And that's where you and I met. Yeah, we met from me interviewing you and then also you actually reviewing a couple chapters of my book, IoT Inc., way back when. I guess it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And since then, after that, I joined the private equity firm for a little while. And then I went back on my own, and that's Digital Operating Partner.
Yeah, that sounds cool. And I really like that because guests like you are the ones that can really bring this breadth of experience, which is not only technology or only business, but you understand how innovation works end to end as a process and how you build an organization or you can change an organization. So, yeah, I'm sure all your experience can bring us a lot of interesting ideas and different ways to look at things. So I would start from the end. in a way. So from okay. your last experience in the private equity, but also talking about your book and your current consulting around the digital operating partner. And I think that would be a very interesting point of view, really thinking from a business perspective. And as you know, Engines of Creation per se focuses on complexity in a very general term, really, on and that really means on understanding that reality and the business where we are is really about understanding how all the different connections, all the different things are connected, and understanding how we can leverage this connection to our benefit. But especially when it comes to a business and a business that you want to improve, you invest on and you want to improve, I'm sure that the first impact when you come there, there is a lot of complexity going on because you really need to understand how the business operates, and you really want to understand what are the leverages that can help you out really to sort of create, I think the correct term is the alpha, to sort right. of to make money in the end and to make your investment worth it. So I really would like to understand with your breadth of experience, how you usually look at the business you want to invest in and you have invested to sort of create these leverages and create value.
Yeah, so let me start just by explaining a little bit of what Digital Operating Partner does, and then it'll put in context of how value is created, which is another way of saying what you just said. Digital Operating Partners, actually, I have written a second book, and that is called Digital Operating Partners, and I think that's what you saw and then go, oh, yeah, Bruce. Digital Operating Partners is an investment book. It's about creating value. So it's focused primarily, almost exclusively on private equity, although there are some what they call strategics, which just means corporations that I work with as well. But generally, it's private equity portfolio companies. And for the private equity portfolio companies, these companies are generally old school. So the more metal, the more old fashioned, the better. And so what I do at Digital Operating Partners is generally work with in the industrial sector, the infrastructure sector, the manufacturing sector. It can be construction sector, retail sector to a certain extent. But I go in and I look at the old technologies and literally do a digital transformation. So digital transformation, you could digitally transform your accounting, you know, from paper or from QuickBooks to an ERP system. That is a form of digital transformation. Another form of digital transformation, and I'm kind of going through the three layers, is the transformation of humans, so more analog, and digitally transforming them into robots in a way. And so you can look at that as the operational, as the secondary layer, the operational layer, first one being the IT and business system layer. And the third layer is where I play. And so the third layer is I use technology such as the Internet of Things, which ties into my background, of course, and then artificial intelligence, although, you know, a lot of it is really just data science, which means really a lot of it is just pure statistics. But we can have that conversation if you like. But I use data science then to take proprietary data from sensors. So I take an old, let's say it's a chipping machine, a wood chipper. And it's the first thing that came up to my mind. So this is old school, but there's ways of improving the chipper. And so the approach would be, I'll talk about the technical approach and then I can talk about the investment approach if you like after that. But the technical approach would be all about collecting proprietary data. So if you're chipper company number one and you're chipper company number two, what is your differential advantage? Well, I would say that one of the biggest differential advantages you can have is having a direct connection with your customer and understanding how they use your products, understand the way they use your products, and very importantly, how they make money using your products. So technically what that means in capturing and then utilizing this proprietary data, the two main technologies are the Internet of Things and then data science. So that's the tools. And as much as I love technology, you know, you heard from my background, I mean, I'm a geek for sure, but what I love more is business. And so IoT Inc. was a business book. The Digital Operating Partners is more of an investment book. And so the approach that I take is kind of a top down and bottom up, and like you said, it's very complex, and so it takes a lot of imagination, but imagination needs to be founded into STEM, I guess is one way of saying it, you know, so understanding the science behind it, understanding the technology behind it, understanding, you know, the data science, just the science around what you're doing. So the chipper, this will be mechanical engineering. So understanding the mechanical engineering of the chipper, understanding how the engine works, how the efficiency is, and so that's the one thing. But the top-down approach is I have a playbook, and effectively I have a playbook that lists all the potential, let's say, digital initiatives that could create value, and then they're grouped in different ways, and this just comes from years and years of experience. And I look at the chipper company, and then just like a pilot before they take off, they have a checklist they go through to make sure they haven't forgot anything. And so that's the top-down approach, and that is just making sure I haven't forgotten anything. And I go through the playbook. But actually, I kind of went in the wrong order, because really what I do is I first start bottom up. And bottom up is using your imagination, where I was going with before, using your imagination to look at the business, look at the competitive space, look at the customers, look at what the key KPIs or the KPIs are for the company, and then trying to imagine a way to create, how do we create value? And for me, generally, this comes down to a number of different ways. You can create value, and this gets into the investment side, as an operating partner. So as the name implies, operating partners come into a company, they improve them, and then after the company is sold, it increases the value. So there's three different ways of creating the value. One is the top end, is the top line revenue. And so this could be customer retention, it could be market size expansion, customer expansion, product expansion, market expansion, pricing optimization. So that's what you look at for how do we increase the revenue. And generally, revenue solves all problems. And so this is by far, if you look at it and you model the impact on the enterprise value, and the equation is very simple. Enterprise value is equal to EBITDA. So let's call that profit, just to simplify things, times the valuation multiple. And the valuation multiple I'll get to in a moment. So the second area that I focus on is margins. So how do we improve margins for the business, for this chipper, you know, for this chipper company, let's say. And then the third area is going to be on the exit multiple. So how do I increase the multiple? So this could be along the lines of looking at other potential companies we could acquire. That would be, you call them add-on companies that would add value to this company. And generally speaking, the bigger the company is, the higher the valuation multiple is. So remember that equation. Another area is going to be on debt management. And so that is basically looking at the free cash flow for a company. And that, again, plays very much into the valuation multiple. And then there's the digital sides of increasing the multiple for, you know, multiple expansion. And that is kind of transforming the company from a traditional company into more of a tech company. And so when you do that, there's a couple things. When you look at comps, so this is what the investors do, and they try to come up with a value when they're either bidding for the company or selling the company, what they do is look at comparables. And so what we do when we transform the company is we kind of make the company a little bit more digital, and therefore the comparable goes from the valuation multiple of, say, an industrial company that makes chippers to the valuation multiple of a industrial company that makes chippers and a software and data science company. So this naturally increases the multiple that the company will be given. And then another one, there's a halo effect that's associated with digital. And the third one is really that you have to do structural changes to the company. And so this is part of the digital transformation, definitely part of the complexity. When you're looking at a company, what we're doing is in the process is developing IP for the company, but then not just developing it for them, but transforming the company so it can, at least it understands the IP that was initially developed and it can extend it. And the only way you can do that is by creating a digital team, and that creates structural changes in the company. So at a very high level, what I'm doing is I'm looking at, again, where the company is, what the company does, who it competes against, what its biggest issues are, what its biggest where the tailwinds are, where the headwinds are, and then I kind of use my imagination, and it'll all come down into really those 10 buckets of value creation.
Yeah, that's amazing. There's a lot to take into account, and there are probably 500 questions, potential questions. But first of all, let me thank you, because when I said I start from the end, probably I start too much from the end. And yes, I forgot to mention your book, which is, as you said, it was really the point where I was really interested in reading your book, because it was kind of bringing together these financial investment aspects with also the technology side and the digital side, as you mentioned. So I would probably now leave the investment questions. And I would definitely, the two areas that I'd be interesting to dive down with you today are, one is the organization, because you touched a very, very interesting point. And the other one is the technology, alluded a few times into the data science, IoT, AI, sure. And I definitely want to spend more time on that. But let's talk about the organization first, because it is definitely something that in my career I've seen over and over, and I'm sure you did as well, that when you are into an industrial context, they tend to be very much hardcore into the specific knowledge, the specific craft, whatever they're doing. You talked about cheaper. They are the best about cheaper. And if you start building a digital team, it becomes something of a weird add-on. And it takes time and a lot of work to make this digital team grow and merge and to change the overall culture. So I'd really be curious to hear from your experience, what are the tips to help a company really transform and become more digital, starting from a very traditional background?
So this may sound like a bit of a cop-out, but I'll kind of lead to the cop-out in a moment. But my first consulting company, IoT Inc., which I sold, it was focused on corporates. And so what that means is who I worked with was, depends on the size of the organization, but it would be either the CEO and his immediate team, or if the company was larger, it would be, let's say, the head of a division and his or her team, and so forth. What I found is, when I was working at IoT Inc. and I was working with these teams, is it was all wonderful and the intentions were all there. And what I would normally do is I would create the strategy part of it, you know, working with the team, but coming up with a strategy for their company, whatever that company may be. And then I would hear nothing. And then sometimes I would hear 2 years later, they would come back and they go, "Oh yeah, you remember?" I go, "Yeah, I remember. Well, we're now ready to maybe do something." And I'd say, "Okay." And then we get a little bit further, and then it would go crickets again. So the lesson I learned is, and this is the cop out now. So the lesson I learned is, I'm not a people digital transformation person. And that the wetware, so there's, you know, hardware is easy, software is easy, but what's really hard is wetware. And so what I learned is, I don't want to do that, because there's too much risk associated with all the things that happen in a company that has a board of directors, and whether they're private or public, it's the same type of pressures. And getting alignment within companies is very difficult. Now, before I get to the cop out, the alignment has to come from the top down. And so even if you're working with a business unit leader, you need to have the CEO and his team totally bought. One, because there's always going to be external pressures. And we can talk about maybe organization. I always recommend creating a startup within a corporation and then isolating that startup from the quarterly pressures of sales, and which, you know, which generally will also derail these type of projects and will mix up with this merging of these teams, so to speak. So the approach that I take, and that'll be pre and post cop out, is to create a startup within the organization. That startup starts really small. It has a leader. It's going to have a tech leader. It's going to have a business leader. It's going to have maybe a support leader, a customer success leader, and it grows as we get further and further on the transformation, we bring in people, and then eventually, once we've done the strategy, we then know what has to be developed. Then we will, and then this is where generally I'll start with an external team, because the corporation or the privately owned company will not have, you know, as we were talking about, they won't have this team. So I'll bring an external team, and then over time, it's kind of boiling the frog very slowly, but over time, expand that start building the internal team, but you need to show success with the external team. Having said that, now we get to the cop-out. The cop-out is that I still found that, even though that's the right way and now it works post-cop-out, but I still found it very difficult. So after I got out of private equity and I learned private equity, I was working as an operating partner for a large private equity firm, I said, no, this is the way to go. It became very clear to me, because a private company is wholly owned by one company, and they're very motivated to create value. And the CEO, and there's no board, there is the private equity company, and sometimes they make a board up, but generally it's not. It's just the partners. It'll be the main partner, and then maybe the managing partner, and then there might be some junior people that'll be part of the decision making. But the cop-out is, I said, I'm going to go to private equity. Now that I have experience here, I'm going to bypass. Now, there's still challenges, but when you have the owners of the company behind you, so now this would be, the analogy would be, in a corporation, I would have the entire board of directors behind me. And that's really tough, you know, to do, just logistically, just in a million different ways, if you think about it for a moment or two. But with a private equity firm, you get contacted by the partners, you work with the partners, you agree on the plan with the partners, and then everybody aligns. And the sense is, they have the CEOs, they have everyone in the company is incentivized to align with the direction of the value creation. And if they don't align, then they find another replacement that will align. And this is what happens with private equity firms, is that they'll look at the management team and they'll say, are they up to the task, and do they want to do the task of changing the company? And it doesn't have to be just digital, because there's many other levers, value creation levers, that private equity firms use, but it's the same for digital. Will this team grab onto this opportunity and execute it? Now, there's no doubt a big part of that is compensation. So you can comp them all along the way, and it's a win-win for everybody. But even then, you still have to make the decision before you make that offer, are they the right people? So the cop-out, Chris, is that I kind of bypass that, and I work with the people that hire me are the private equity firms. The people that pay me are the companies, because the private equity firms say, pay him. And I bypass that whole thing. But I still do the same approach. So, you know, from an organizational change perspective, what I do is I build an internal team, start it as a startup. I isolate it from the rest of the business so people are not having to think about two different jobs, so to speak, and then grow that team internally. And then, as I was saying, build the tech team, both on the software development and the data science side, over time, incorporate it into this startup. And then once it releases the product, you can then decide what you want to do, whether it becomes a different division, whether it becomes a subset of another division. But what I found in my whole bunch of years doing this is that there's a lot of different approaches. You can have advisory boards, there's a whole bunch of different approaches. But what I found over the time is, from a change management, for what you can control, that's the best approach.
I have to say that as a cop-out was probably the best I ever heard of. So thanks a lot for sharing that with us. But you explained the journey, and actually that was very valuable, because you managed to go through all the pain points that you have when you want to do this digital transformation. Mm-hmm. And especially, as you pointed out, if you are in a large company with a board, possibly private or public, but you have this difficulty of creating the consensus. And so alignment. In a sense, you have to create this alignment, you have to create this culture and bring everybody along. And I've been in a situation myself where you sit down with people that look at you and they are like, I'm going to be retired in 5 years. Why should I care? Why should I care? Not because they are bad people, literally. why should I? I mean, if there is no personal gain and there is no motivation, but these people might still have the power to slow things down. And as you said, on the other end, you can find better instruments. And I see the private equity to me as an instrument to push this change in a more effective way. The other one you touched upon that is to sort of push kind of the innovation. And they talk about innovation at the edge, and there are a lot of ways to call that, but create a startup within the organization that is somehow protected, and they can do their own stuff without necessarily being dragged into too many conversations. As far as I'm concerned, I didn't consider it a cop-out. I consider it an optimization. You had the time in your career to try different things, and you managed to find the most optimized way, or one of the most optimized way to create the change that you wanted to create. So now I would move more on the digital side. Probably have been already running around the block for quite some time. When I look and when I see AI and I sort of look under the hood, as you mentioned, it's data science, it's statistics. Sometimes it's like it's stuff that was there 30 years ago and has been rebranded with the AI label, but reality is just good statistic. I'm going to say just good. It's actually a lot of work that you need to put in there.
It's been around for hundreds of years, yeah.
What really makes the difference is the computational power that we have now and we didn't have 100 years ago. And so in the example that you provided earlier, it could be the cheaper company, an industrial company, and you start collecting data. How do you use that data, and what kind of approach you usually use to create value out of that data?
Yeah, so let me just pop up a layer and start with kind of putting things in context. So when I look at any business, what I'm focused on is value. So that is what I was saying earlier, is that imagination and then the playbook and identifying where the value is. Then the next step is identifying what information do I need to create that value. And then after that, it's what data do I need to create that information, to create that value. And then only then do we start getting into the technologies of, you know, what type of AI pipeline, what type of IoT platform, what type of sensors, you know, what type of edge devices and all that. So I just wanted to first say, Chris, that, you know, that's in my view, the right perspective is work top down, and then you get to the technology. Now, when we get to the data, it's not only collecting the right data, but it's also transforming it. Now, collecting the data is super important, because if you don't have the right data, as you're aware, and probably many of your listeners are aware, you can't create anything of value. You can't create models. But where I start when I start looking at the technology is always in the digital twin. Now, the digital twin is just one way of saying a virtual representation of something physical. That's my interpretation of a digital twin. You could argue that an animation system, and I used to be in the 3D animation business, is a digital twin. True, it's a visual representation. But what I'm talking about is where is value created? So in the chipper example, the value would be in the mechanical engineering and the efficiency of it, maybe the blade design and so forth. So where I start is understanding what's the model that we need to develop in order to create the value. So remembering that chain. And there's a number of models that I use all the time at a very high level. Let's call them a simulation model. So this is now simulating how the chipper works. So understanding, again, the mechanical engineering, understanding the physics. This is where I was getting to the STEM, understanding the energy usage and so forth. The next model that I use very often is utility model. And utility model says basically, what do they use the product for? How is it being used? The next one is a usability model. And this could, you know, you could think of this, the analogy would be, well, the analogy for all of them is software, in the sense of the utility model would be, I use spreadsheets always for doing personal budgets. That would be utility. That would be an example of utility model. And if you had this model behind a spreadsheet and you always recognize, oh, we got the rent, we got the food expense, then you can make a leap of faith. And this is obviously a very simple example, just to, you know, kind of clarify the concept. You could leap of faith that, okay, the way they use the spreadsheet is for budgeting. Same thing for the chipper. So you could say, how do they use, what's the utility? So how do they use, what do they use the chipper for? And from the model, the utility model, you could say, oh, it must be big chips. It must be chips made out of having this density. It must be chips that have this, you know, this moisture, whatever the case is. If that's important, then you can measure that type of data. For usability, it would be, again, let's say a spreadsheet. It would be, how do they use the UI? So what's the way they use the UI? And then if you can understand how they use the UI, you can organize the interface in a more efficient way so that the things that are being used either on mass or for a particular person, you could reorganize the interface, for example, to make it more efficient to use the spreadsheet. Same thing for the chipper. You can see, how is the chipper used? How do they actually program it? How do they instigate it? How do they, you know, what buttons do they press? And the same thing is, you can then look at ways of improving it. And then the fourth model is going to be a monetization model. And again, this is pretty high level, but the concept is really, how do they make money with this chipper? And this will come, it's not going to say how they make money with the chipper, because you're going to know how they make money with the chipper. What you're doing is simulating how they make money with the chipper, because this gets us into business models, which takes us back into business. But you want to build a business model that interfaces with their business model in the cleanest possible way, so that there's the least friction possible. So that is monetization model. So if they, so I'm just using this and I'm making it up as we go, but if they use chippers and they make money by the amount of chips they create or by the hour, if they, you know, if their business model is, that's probably more accurate, a per hour business model, then a very simple example would be, we would measure time that the chipper is being used. And then we would have the option as a chipper manufacturer to say, you know what, we can charge you a one-time price, or we could charge you by how much you used a chipper, you know, as an example. And that is compelling, because that's how they make money. So if they're, it, maybe it's hourly. So then it would be, how many hours do you use the chipper? Then we would know how many hours to use the chipper. We would know from doing our diligence what they charge per hour to use the chipper. And again, this is just an example that could be extended to any situation. And then we can then build a business model and price the product, and pricing optimization is a big thing, is pricing the product in a way that they make money and we make money. So those are really the four main models that we develop, and then how they're executed, it really doesn't matter to me, in the sense that what I'm doing is designing a value map and how that value is created. And then the technology, whatever, you know, then we can go into, generally the next approach is to do an RFP, because again, the companies don't generally have this talent internally. And then where I care about the technology really is just the efficiency in terms of what it can do, how much custom development has to be done, how much it costs. And so really, really comes down to, again, a business decision. But at the technology, you know, perspective, like I was saying, value, information, data, technology, and then where you zoom in is this digital twin. And then you have this living, over time, it gets more and more accurate. And then you have a copy, a digital representation of this physical chipper. And over time, you can see the more and more accurate this digital twin gets, you can start playing with it, and you can start doing a lot of innovations with it. And that gets us into, you know, market share expansion, particularly as having a more attractive product.
I like the way you show the value of a digital twin. I've been involved in industrial B2B myself. That's the reason, because many years ago we met when you were at your IoT Inc. firm. But to be fair, I've seen many times having many companies taking a more technology-led approach, which was more like, we build the digital twin and magic will happen. And it's usually not the right way. Starting from the value, you actually can see that the digital twin can provide magic in a way, but it is linked to a value that has been mapped. And also what leads to is that you don't need sometimes a lot of complexity in the solution. Talking about complexity myself, is sometimes you don't need that much. Okay, you might just need a few sensors. And yes, you talked about the example in the business model on time monetization. You just need maybe to know when it is on and off. push it on some cloud server, and that's all you need to change your business model and make more money. Of course, we are oversimplifying in that sense. That's really the mindset. If you start from the value, you don't overinvest unnecessarily into a lot of stuff. But I also see an industry trend going on. Of course, as you said, when your digital twin grows and it becomes more more complex with more moving parts, also becomes something that, let me use this word, it becomes alive, okay? In the sense that live data becomes more and more important, and you can somehow start closing the loop in the sense that digital twin is not necessarily a tool that a human uses to make decision, but it becomes a tool that can take decision itself and operate directly on your value chain, whatever that is. And I really would like to get from you, what's the trend? Again, because a lot of industrial applications don't necessarily need that, but we can see that this is the direction of travel, and how much is this real versus it is still science fiction?
The live digital twin, or closing the loop, so to speak, is really the holy grail of having this digital representation. So if we break it down a little bit, what we're doing is we're building a model, and we're trying to reduce the complexity of the real world, because that's why it's always statistic. Let's talk about the chipper again, since we're talking about the chipper. I'm not going to model mechanical engineering. I'm not going to model thermodynamics. I'm not going to model material science to know about sharpness. What I'm going to do is I'm going to create a simple simulation by looking at the outcome of the chipper. And again, it's where I'm looking at is how the chipper creates value. And therefore, what we're doing is we're taking something that's super complex. And I'll tell you, even modeling a spring, as simple a device as that is, you've got to take into consideration, what's the metal? What's the thickness? What's the shape? How big is it? What temperature is it? What's the viscosity of the environment that it's in? And so on and so on. Is there electric charge? Is there magnetic field? And when you get into that, we're just talking about like a spring. So when we start talking about complexity, what we do is we just statistically sample it, and we sample the outcome. And then it's similar to drawing a curve through a whole bunch of, you know, points, however number of dimensions you want to think about it. But that's the simplification. That's how you get that digital twin. So you need to understand the mechanical engineering to understand what the sample and also be able to interpret it. But I want to just make clear, when I talked about the STEM, ultimately what we're getting into is going to be statistics. And we're going to get into a statistical representation of whatever that value creation is. So now talking about the closing the loop and this live digital twin, that's the goal. And there's one project that has done that, but I'll tell you generally what it is. And in this case, let's talk about the chipper. I would do an efficiency model. So once we simulate the chipper, we can now have basically a mathematical equation that represents the performance of the chipper. Now, once we have it in a mathematical form, we can solve for different things. We can solve for, well, listen, you know what we really want is the chipper to use the least amount of energy possible. Okay, so then we take that equation and we solve for energy usage. No, what we really want is this chipper to be able to do it as fast as possible. So then we take the equation, we solve for performance. And so, you know, it'd be some form of increasing the amount of throughput of those pieces of wood through the chipper. So once we have our goal functions in the sense of what it's going to be, you know, I just brought up two, you could come up with a whole bunch of others. We want to make it the least expensive, and that could be all energy, but it could be manpower. So there's a bunch of different things. But generally where we are in the state of the art, that we've built the model, and then again, that's been a simplification of the complexity of this chipper. And then we start feeding it the live data from the chipper. And by feeding it the live data from the chipper, we can say, hey, how are these settings compared to an optimized model that we're putting the data through? Well, actually, I think you need to turn up the volume, you know, whatever volume means metaphorically in this case, you need to turn up the volume a little bit to improve the efficiency. Generally, what the state of the art is now is we produce a report, and that report says, turn up the volume by 2, you know, and that'll make your chipper more efficient. But at the same time, generally what we'll do is we'll put actuators. So actuators is kind of the opposite of a sensor, in the sense of sensors taking the real world environment and putting it into digital.
an actuator goes the other way. An actuator like turns knobs, let's say. So an actuator will take digital and then manifest it in a physical way. So the next step is then to do the actuation, and that closes that. That's the one that closes the loop. But right now, from my experience, and I am working on a project right now where we are going to do this. So we're building the actuators right into the system right now. The goal is to do this. But generally, the state of the art right now is to have it manually done, but inform the operator what has to be done.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it checks out clearly with also my experience. And it is on the leading edge. There are situations where you have the need to close the loop, I would say, but it's clearly the technical complexity to do that not necessarily is justified by the efficiency gain. Because as you said, you can still use a human to do the actual decision-making actuation, but the digital twin provide all the necessary information to give the right decision.
Sometimes because of safety too. So if you have an automated, you know, chipper, you can imagine that chipper could be dangerous. And so there might be regulations. Again, I'm just overusing this example, but there may be regulations for this machine, that safety regulations that don't allow, or that would be potentially compromised if it's making these decisions on its own.
Regulations is also a very important point, especially in industrial environment. Not only, there are all in general regulated environment, because there is also an element sometimes where regulation is perceived to slow down innovation, but it might also be the thing that can help actually manage more properly in industry without being a wild west. What's your experience with regulations, I suppose? Do you see them as helpful in the decision making or slowing down the innovation?
Well, from an innovation point of view, it kind of blocks things a little bit because the regulations haven't caught up to what the technology can do. And in reality, you could make an argument that whether it's an artificial intelligence learning model could make a better decision than a human. However, so that would be more innovative, and that might be even more safe. And I think you could argue that in many cases, like anti-lock braking and like automatic braking today. You know, in the past, the regulations didn't allow that. It had to be someone that pressed it, but you could see how a little bit of technology could improve things. So right now, I see regulations as being important, of course, but I see them a little bit behind. I see them a little bit behind of where the technology is. And even though it might be, you know, for example, you could have in this chipper, you could have it sense when it lifts up, when the density of the material is no longer wood, you could literally stop it within 1/1000th of a second. And therefore, even if you put your hand inside the chipper, again, you know, just using this analogy, you could tell that it's not the density, for example, of a piece of wood, and you could immediately stop it. Whereas a human, you know, if someone accidentally put their hand in it, it might take a second. It might even take 3 seconds. And you can imagine the damage that would be done. So at a high level, I just think, you know, regulations are important, but they're generally haven't caught up with the technology. And so it can, like you were saying, it can stifle innovation a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. The alignment between regulation and technology is very important. And as we know, lawmaking in general tends to be slower, at least, of technology, especially of technology that are evolving from an exponentially. And we can see clearly around us over the last few decades how exponentially fast that can be. That's a good point. And honestly, I was also thinking while you were mentioning about this chipper for, I don't know, many times now, that might be the title of this episode. But it was definitely a good example. And I think it provided very grounded and clear reference and metaphor. So a last question around digital twins. And we were talking about closing the loop and using AI really to make decisions and act on automatically using actuators, as you said. So we are in this age of AI where things are becoming more and more automated. And I was watching earlier today some recent development on self-driving cars. Well, you live in California, so I'm sure you see a lot of them going around. Mm-hmm. And what do you see? What's your view for the future? Do you see these automated digital twins, these live digital twins, replacing humans eventually or more augmenting humans?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the use case. But I, you know, generally, I think you're going to see augmentation. But it's very freaky. I'm driving down the street in San Francisco where I live, and there's a car right beside me that there's nobody inside. And I think everybody will remember the first time, you know, it's our generation in a sense, in my, you know, this time frame. But I looked down, I remember the very first time, it was at night, I was coming home from a friend's place, and there it was. It was a car with the lights on. They also put the lights on inside, so they're not, I guess it's maybe so they're not trying to fool anyone to make it really clear. But I looked down, because I have an SUV, I looked down at a car, and there was no one in it. So it's definitely going to be automation in many, many different places. Automating driving turns out to be super complicated, way more complicated than automating flying or automating swimming. But I think it really depends on the use case. But ultimately, I think augmentation is where it'll start. And you can think about level 3 and level 4, I think it is, for automated driving, where you have to have the human in the loop, and then eventually you don't. And I think it was Mercedes that just recently was one of the first companies, which is kind of surprising to me, given that the profile isn't with Mercedes, but their most expensive model, so their 500 SL, I think it is, they have full, and I think it's level 5 autonomy, but under the strict conditions of traffic. So if it's in a traffic, then they go there. So I think, you know, over time it'll get more and more, but you know, in the near future, I think augmented is probably where we're going.
There is a lot of concern, which is, I think, right. But if you look back in history, we have seen technology somehow disrupting for sure, but in general augmenting us, not necessarily replacing us too cool. But we know we are in the age of augmented general intelligence. So hopefully not, but we might be wrong. And so thanks a lot for this incredible overview. And really, we started very, very high from a point of view of business. And now you run a business, now you optimize a business, and we went deep down into digital twins, sensors, actuators, chippers. So that was a great journey. So as is now becoming the final staple question for Engines of Creation that I asked all my guests, what are, for you, the characteristic of a leader who embraces complexity?
It's just one word, imagination. I think a leader that has imagination will be able to see what's been presented to them, will be able to see things that aren't being presented to them. And, but again, similar to what I said earlier, imagination is always founded on the person's background. And so depending on the type of leader, then you're obviously going to need to know your stuff. You're going to need to know your business. You're going to need to know your tech very well. But I think what differentiates leaders or true good leaders is you're going to need to have to know your people so far, but it's going to be imagination.
I love this answer. It's simple, but it gives that freedom. And I think it goes very well also on the previous point about AI. And it's that's what makes us different. It's like it's the imagination. And that's what can really differentiate us from the point of view of creating value in the future. So that was great having you. Thanks a lot for all your very, very clear answers and explanation. I really enjoyed them. I'm sure the listeners have enjoyed them too. So yeah, thanks a lot. And hopefully we'll have you soon in this podcast again.
All right. Thank you, Chris. I enjoyed the time speaking with you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Engines of Creation. I hope you enjoyed this captivating exploration of the digital landscape with Bruce Sinclair. From the strategic considerations of digital transformation to the nuanced complexities of implementing technologies like digital twins. If you want to learn more, be sure to follow Engines of Creation and leave us a rating and a review. And don't hesitate to share this episode on social media with your friends and colleagues. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, feel free to reach out to angelsofcreation@masterdonato.co. I'll be glad to continue the conversation. Angels of Creation will be back in February with a great episode about AI and its responsible applications. Arrivederci.